structured a British law firm, Lay and Day. I mean, Lay and Day, you know, has represented, you know, a group of Kenyans in the past and won in the British courts. So the case, they've taken up the case for that woman called Wanjiru or something, yeah, for that woman in the British court. So we expect, you know, to get justice for that poor woman.
Amnesty International and Impact say that at least 650 women had been raped by British troops between 1965 and 2001, and that there was a conspiracy of silence on these crimes. Now, human rights organizations say there is a deliberate and shocking attempt to obstruct justice for Kenyan victims of UK military abuses. Now, what's your take on this?
The UK authorities cannot, you know, obstruct or cannot escape justice, because I know that Kenya has a long history, I mean, of tackling or fighting abuses by the Kenyans, by the British authorities. I mean, even historical abuses. There was one case recently where the descendants of and even some survivors of the British atrocities committed against the Mau Mau in the pre-independence days were brought to court, and they won. Okay, and I know that Kenya will not rest until they receive justice for all the atrocities, all the wrongdoings perpetrated or committed by the British troops in the country. So I'm very confident of a very just outcome, you know, for the Kenyans.
All thanks to Jonathan Ofei Ansah for his insight. Indeed, there are high expectations that Britain's crimes and impunity in Kenya will end as the country's judiciary asserts the sovereignty of this East African nation. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss plans by the European Union to import more gas from Africa amid the crisis in Ukraine. Stay with us.
Can Africa replace Russia's gas in Europe? You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Amid the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the European Union is reportedly planning to boost energy cooperation with African countries. Now, this is expected to replace Russian natural gas imports and reduce dependence on Moscow by almost two-thirds this year.
According to projection, Africa's LNG production is forecast at 73 billion cubic meters in 2022. A draft EU document says countries in Africa, in particular Nigeria, Senegal, and Angola, offer largely untapped potential for liquefied natural gas.
Italy has already taken the first step by signing an agreement with Angola last month to increase gas supplies from the southern African country. Tete Antonio, the Angolan Minister of External Relations, speaks here after the gas agreement with Italy.
This is the first step of many, because we have a diversified cooperation with Italy. I think everything is in place for strong cooperation, and especially a strategic partnership.
Now, for more on plans by Europe to import more gas from Africa, we contacted Paolo Raffone, the Secretary General of CIPI Foundation. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
No problem. My pleasure.
Now, our first question to you, sir. Can Africa replace Russia's gas exports to Europe?
Well, this is a theoretical question because, in fact, there is the possibility to use some of the gas reserves in certain African countries like Mozambique or Nigeria or even Congo. But the real problem is the extraction and the logistics to transport it to Europe. So it is a very, I would say, medium-term target that, yes, can be made technically, but it will take time and a huge investment of funds to make it feasible.
Most African countries lack infrastructure in the gas sector and have to rely on Western multinationals. If these challenges are not addressed, Africa will not reap the benefits of its vast gas reserves. An official of the Abuja Chamber of Commerce and Industry speaks here on the challenges facing the gas sector.
You all know that gas is cheap, gas is clean, and gas is green. So why are we not utilizing our gas resources in Nigeria effectively? That's the concern, and that's the narrative we want to bring to the fore. The biggest challenge is infrastructure. Infrastructure is the biggest challenge, and the government should allow private sector partner with them to enable them build infrastructure in Nigeria too, so that the average Nigerian can have access to gas resources. That's the biggest challenge that we have.
What can African countries do to avoid exploitation by Western oil and gas multinationals?
Well, because of the huge investments necessary in the African countries to operationalize the extraction and the treatment of gas for its transportation, it's evident that this is a sort of new colonial kind of intervention, and I have serious doubts that the African countries would like to go back in history with the Europeans heavily involved into the situation at domestic level to have the gas extracted. So I think it will create a lot of reactions among the population, and even certain governments would not be so keen to participate in this endeavor.
A major concern regarding Africa replacing Russia's gas in Europe is the financial aspect. Nigeria's Minister of State for Petroleum Resources, Timi Prasilva, says his country is ready to offer its services as an alternative gas supplier to Europe. In a meeting with European Union diplomats in Abuja, he urged the EU to increase investments in gas and hydrocarbons in Nigeria to be able to meet the bloc's energy needs.
We should please work together towards the future as partners, and that Nigeria will be very willing, and we are very well positioned to be a reliable partner, reliable supplier of energy to Europe.
Now, how can African countries finance the continent's gas project to avoid unfair preconditions imposed by European countries?
There is no way that African countries by themselves can finance the needed investments to have the gas produced and stocked and then transported. So the possibility is only to get loans that can be given by European financial institutions or the IMF, World Bank, and so on. But again, it will take time, and the conditions attached to those loans may be very unfavorable for the African countries. So I see it a remote possibility. Also, the mood of these countries is not so keen to join the Western-led war with Russia. So we have seen it in the United Nations Assembly vote and in other occasions. I would say that also should be seen that the only two African countries which have been brought to Ramstein by the Americans in their meeting against Russia, only two, Kenya and Liberia. So this shows that the continent, made out of 53 countries, is not so keen to follow the Americans. Even Morocco, that was present in Ramstein, was brought there reluctantly. So I really see it as an idea that can work, but in a completely different setup from today and in the medium long term.
Last year, Nigeria's President Buhari announced the Decade of Gas, an initiative designed to ensure the people of this country benefit from this natural resource.
Gas has enormous potential to diversify and uplift Nigeria's economy, given the country's potential of about 600 trillion cubic feet of gas and the rising global demand for cleaner energy sources has offered Nigeria an opportunity to exploit gas resources for the good of the country. We intend to seize this opportunity. Nigeria LNG contributes about 1% to GDP and has contributed $114 billion in revenues over the years.
How can African countries supply gas to Europe yet barely meet their domestic needs?
I think that the sovereignty on the natural resources should be the objective of all African states. Already they are being exploited by other kinds of mineral extractions. Let's think Congo, but even Nigeria. And we see all the problems that are linked to these activities financed and operated by Western multinationals. I think that the Africans this time will not abide to a new neocolonial style action by Europeans just because they need suddenly their gas and therefore accept any condition. It will be a lengthy negotiation.
Western powers seeking to isolate Russia over Ukraine are disappointed at what they see as lukewarm support from African nations at the UN General Assembly. As our guest mentioned earlier, most African countries are not aligned with Western policies and stances on the Ukraine conflict. Now, how will this impact on the continent's move to replace Russia's gas in Europe?
I believe so. Yes, the Africans are much more self-confident today in certain countries. Let's take South Africa, which is the most prominent and active on this ground, is much more interested to be part of emerging powers game, so the famous BRICS in conjunction with Russia and China, than to go back to the old colonial relations with Europe. So I do think that politically, Africa is quite different from what it was, of course, and will not accept easily to replace the Russian gas at the cost of their state building and reaffirmation of sovereignty that they have gained only a few decades ago. So they will be very wary on accepting any condition from Europe. And we see also the nervousness in Europe is so high that they are trying to revive the Iranian nuclear deal in order to have another opportunity to get the gas instead of Russia. But the reaction of Iran has been very cold at the moment. They're not rushing into it.
We'd like to thank Paolo Raffone for his insight, and we'll keep our eyes on this subject in our future programs. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. You can send us your comments through our social media handle, and goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The coming mass migration of flood-prone areas will have huge social and economic costs, but the US government doesn't have an adequate plan. We now present you an article written by Max Ufberg. The piece is titled, It's Happening Now: How rising sea levels are causing a U.S. migration crisis. Sea levels have risen about 9 inches since 1880, with one-third of that gain from the last 25 years alone. Every year, a flurry of reports are published warning of the risk to towns and cities along the coastal areas of the United States. It's one thing to hear about a looming disaster, it's another to see the cataclysm play out in real time. That's what's happening in Tahola, a village on Washington's coast that acts as the capital for the Quinault Indian Nation, a tribe of about 3,600 members. In Tahola, climate change caused sea level rise has brought to the community a fast receding shoreline, and with it, a heightened threat of flooding. According to Quinault estimates, the ocean level could increase by 2.6 feet by 2100, pushing storm surges higher and bringing waves closer to town. On an overcast February morning, Raleigh Ralston, the 62-year-old treasurer of the Quinault Nation, drove his silver Ford SUV down a network of Tahola's unmarked gravel roads, telling me about what this place used to look like before climate change permanently reconfigured the landscape. Parked on a rock face overlooking the Pacific Ocean, he nodded towards a moss-covered boulder towering out of the water. As a kid in the 1960s, Larry Ralston said, he was able to trek by foot to the rock. And now, he reckons the water is 30 feet deep. Back then, the ocean didn't seem like a menace, at least not an existential one. But that's no longer the case. Some 660 Tahola residents who border the ocean now find themselves living in an increasingly dangerous flood zone. The only solution is for everyone and everything in the village to move uphill. Larry Ralston said, "We can see firsthand what's happening. There is no denying it. Tahola signals what's to come for coastal communities across the country." Already about 15 million American homes are at risk of flooding, and the threat is only going to get worse. A report released in February by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, projected that sea level along the U.S. coastline would rise by 10 to 12 inches on average in the next 30 years. An uptick that would make damaging flooding occur 10 times more often than it does today. William Sweet, an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Ocean Service and the country's top scientist studying sea level rise, said, "It's important to understand in these communities that sea level rise is happening now. Its impacts are happening now, and those impacts will grow worse in the next 30 years. Mining nuisance flooding will be replaced by flooding that's more damaging to economies and to infrastructure. That future could very well touch off a mass migration of people away from coastline and flood zones." Research published in 2020 in the journal PLOS ONE estimated that sea level rise could cause over 13 million Americans to relocate inland by 2100. An outcome with huge economic, social and political consequences. Yet, even with the deluge of warnings, there is no centralized lifeline available to coastal communities in the United States. There are a number of federal programs designed to give assistance to such areas through government bodies like the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But those pots of money are far from adequate to tackle a problem of this scale. Some local governments have chosen to offer, and in a few cases mandate, buyouts to homeowners in vulnerable areas, who wind up dispersing. Others would prefer to keep the neighborhood intact, in Tahola's case, by moving the whole village. In 2017, the Quinault Tribal Council adopted the Tahola Village Relocation Master Plan, which would move the lower enclave of the village about a half a mile uphill by 2030. where a new 200-acre development would offer flood-free land for over 300 housing units, a police station, a courthouse, a K-12 school and a museum, among other buildings. The initiative makes the Quinault among the first in the United States, alongside communities in Louisiana and Alaska, among others, to voluntarily opt for a strategy of managed retreat away from impending climate threats. To date, the council has been able to build a new administrative complex, a so-called Generations building, to house Head Start and senior programs, and approximately 150 homes. Construction that is owed to a combination of U.S. Department of Agriculture grants, housing and urban development money, and the tribe's own funds. To pay for the rest, Larry Ralston estimates they'll need an additional $200 million, a daunting sum, especially considering the bipartisan infrastructure bill that was signed into law by President Biden last year provided just $130 million to support relocation efforts for the 574 federally recognized tribes across the United States. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, there are roughly 5.7 million American Indians and Alaska Natives in the United States, many of whom are on the front lines of climate change. A multi-year study published last year in the journal Science found that indigenous nations in the United States not only lost 99% of their historical land, but what relatively little they were eventually allotted are often more exposed to climate change hazards than their historical lands. The Quinault Nation settled permanently on their 189,621-acre reservation, much of it conifer forest and unsuitable to farming, in the 19th century, after a long and at times contentious negotiation with the Washington government and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Though the allotted land was still a far cry from what was lost, the ocean provided a natural icebox for sockeye salmon, known as blueback among the Quinault peoples, a unique fish that is central to the Quinault identity, and is under threat due in part to ocean acidification and warmer waters. Larry Ralston said, as his SUV ambled past a large illustrated cutout of the salmon affixed to a lamppost, "There's a parity between the Quinault people and the blueback. We try to save our blueback so we can save ourselves." Just 2 weeks later and 2,400 some miles away from Tahola, I was in the Allen Field subdivision of Houston, Texas, talking with Dolores Mendoza, a 35-year-old mother of three. She is trying to figure out how to convince people in the neighborhood, many of whom are relatives, that the country's effort to remove them from their homes shouldn't be ignored. Tahola and Harris County are a study in contrasts. The former, a cash-strapped program that, if successful, would keep a neighborhood intact, and the latter, a messy but better-funded effort that will ultimately move people out of high-risk zones but tear a community apart. I met Dolores Mendoza, who works as a credit controller at an inspection agency, on a chilly afternoon at her former home, a three-bedroom house that's just a stone's throw from the Greens Bayou watershed. Harris County bought the place in December, paying Mendoza a total of $300,000 for the property, $70,000 for the house, and $230,000 to relocate. The sale was a coup for her, given that she paid $62,000 to buy the 1,200 square feet house in 2010. She has since moved to Kingwood, a wealthier neighborhood about 15 miles away. That's not to say that Dolores Mendoza was keen on leaving. She grew up in Allenfield and, by her count, still has family living in 13 different nearby houses. She said, "I wanted this community. It's not pretty to look at, but my family's here. It's only a matter of time before that's no longer the case." As we walked through the beige-coloured house, which had been ransacked and vandalised in the 2 months since its sale, Mendoza recalled how the place used to look when she and her three children lived there. Harris County is a sprawling region of 4.7 million people, about half of whom live in Houston, Texas. Much like Tahola, it is caught in climate change's crosshairs. Hurricanes are becoming more common in the area, bringing with them enough rainwater to flood the state's bayou systems. Hurricane Harvey, which hit Houston in 2017 and took the lives of at least 88 individuals in Texas, was the third 500-year flood within the last 3 years. Worse yet, the Texas coastline has sunk about 2 feet within the last century, due in part to excessive groundwater pumping, making the state more vulnerable to flooding. But Harris County also bears a different distinction. It is the national leader in federally funded home buyouts, responsible for some 2,500 acquisitions, on top of 1,000 homes purchased by the Harris County Flood Control District with local funds. Since the 1980s, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, has supported over 43,000 property buyouts in the United States. That is well short of the 3.63 million people in the country who are likely to encounter flooding every year. Cesafe.
Aperture.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
31-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just to someone and I can rest, and I can rest, and me and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. And next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They'd work from sunup to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums and their swags and everything. We used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any work day. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shrinks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, if they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white or bleached white where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many. And if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches, but at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor?
I told the doctor.
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife, Marion, has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Ollie interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles, or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. You put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this. And it's something that can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it. And I just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than three decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself. It's hard.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature birth. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial, and I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Well, Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. Once more, Quds Day has arrived. Holy Quds calls all Muslims in the world. The activities in Jenin has enraged the Zionist regime to the point of madness. This is while 20 years ago, the usurping regime killed 200 people in the Jenin refugee camp in response to the death of a few Zionists in Naharia, with the purpose of forever concluding the Jenin matter. Polls show that almost 70% of the Palestinians in the 1948 and 1967 lands and in the surrounding camps encouraged the Palestinian leaders to carry out attacks on the Zionist regime. This is an important phenomenon because it signifies the complete preparedness of the Palestinians to confront the usurping regime, and it provides the Mujahid organizations with the freedom to take military action whenever they deem necessary.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The jihadi moves of the people of Palestine in the two northern and southern parts of the 1948 lands, and at the same time the massive rallies in Jordan and Eastern Quds, the brave defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Palestinian youth, and the military maneuvers in Gaza indicate that all of Palestine has turned into an arena of resistance. At the present time, the people of Palestine are unanimous about continuing this struggle on the path of God. These incidents and what has occurred in Palestine in recent years is a seal of annulment on all schemes for compromise with the Zionist enemy. This is because no scheme or plan about Palestine is implementable in the absence of Palestine or against the consent of its owners, the Palestinians. This means that all former agreements such as the Oslo Accord, the Arabian two-state solution, the deal of the century, and the recent humiliating attempts for the normalization of relations have been nullified.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.